The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events here, and I thank you very much for joining us. I'm also pleased to welcome our two historians, Harold Holzer, who by day serves as the Senior Vice President for External Affairs at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and who by night is the author and editor of more than 40 books on the Civil War era and one of our best-known Lincoln scholars. Mr. Holzer is joined this evening by another esteemed scholar, who knows a thing or two about Lincoln, as his two previous books attest, and many before. James McPherson is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his one-volume History of the Civil War, Battle Cry of Freedom, the author of more than 30 books, and emeritus professor of history at Princeton University. Tonight, our guests will discuss the early years of the Civil War, and they'll also take up the gestation of Hearts Touched by Fire, a book that has been called a model of scholarship and historical editing. And the book is based on the Battles and Leaders of the Civil War series and the remarkable collection of first-person accounts contained therein. Please welcome Harold Holzer and James McPherson.
Thank you, and good evening. It's great to be in Philadelphia and at the library, a city where Abraham Lincoln famously raised the flag at Independence Hall on Washington's birthday 150 years and some months ago, declaring that he would rather be assassinated on this spot than to surrender it. It sounded very brave and very prescient when he said it, until we learned that the night before he had been told that he was probably going to be killed on the way to Washington. And this is the city where he decided to heed the warnings about the assassination plots that awaited him in Baltimore en route to his presidency. Here is where he also said, talking about the Declaration of Independence, that he never had a feeling, a political feeling, that did not spring from the promise in the Declaration that the weights should be lifted from the shoulders of all men and that all should have an equal chance. We're here, as our host said, to talk about a project that we began undertaking about a year and a half ago, and which I thought would be a unique way to contribute to the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, and that is to celebrate and revive and interpret one of the most influential books about Civil War memory that was ever published, and that is Battles and Leaders of the Civil War. Four huge volumes that appeared after all of its articles, or nearly all of its articles, had been serialized in a magazine called The Century. You know, I think if we had done this in another 5 years, people might not know what magazines are, but to know about a magazine like this that had influential articles and series every month. They were also running a Lincoln. They ran a nine-volume Lincoln biography in the Century magazine, overlapping with this Civil War series. How it began was an office discussion. I guess we would call it a water cooler debate, although in 5 years, right? We won't know what a water cooler is because we all have bottles of water in our offices. But it was a water cooler discussion between two young editors, just got to talking about what each thought was the bloodiest battle of the Civil War. And they debated and debated and didn't come to an agreement, but they went to their editor, Richard Watson Gilder, who's also a poet, and said, if this is so engaging to us, disputatious and fun, maybe it would interest our readers. And they thought about it and developed it into a very ambitious plan to go back This is about 1883. Go back to the people who had fought the battles of the war, the leaders. Ask them about the battles. Ask them to recount what had happened through their own eyes. Not talk about the controversies so much, maybe, and that may be a weakness in the series. Frankly, no discussion of slavery to speak of. But to talk about the strategies, the tactics, the bravery on the field, the engineering marvels, the topography, that was the idea. And what these editors decided to do was go general catching, as they said. Let's get the big guns. So they went after Ulysses S. Grant first. He was the biggest catch. And Ulysses S. Grant said, basically, are you kidding? I have other things to do. I'm not doing this book. I think that if he had not, in the next couple of months, been financially wiped out, there would not be a Battles and Leaders of the Civil War. Suddenly, Ulysses S. Grant was broke. And $500 an article seemed like an awful lot of money for a man who was destitute and had no prospects and had debts. So Grant began writing. He was edited heavily in his first article because the editors didn't like the way he did it, and through Battles and Leaders developed his famous simple style that became a hallmark in his own memoirs. And so the series attracted other great writers and generals, McClellan. They went to Joe Johnston and said, are you going to write? And he said, are you kidding? I'm doing my own memoirs. And they said, well, you know, Jefferson Davis is writing for us. He said, that bum, I'm writing for you. I want to dispute everything he says. Davis, interestingly, is the one person who talked his way out of the book. He agreed to be in it. He had only one demand, and that is that every word he produced for the book had to be published exactly as is, with no editing and no questions. And there the editors drew their line in the sand and said, not for you, not for anybody. And they lost Jefferson Davis, but they kept Johnston. And what we had as a result were these extraordinary recollections, beautifully illustrated, because not only did they go back to the heroes, to the leaders, they went to the artists, many of whom Philadelphia trained, like Xanthus Smith, the great naval marine artist of the Civil War, Thurd de Thulstrup, who did military art, Alan Redwood, a Confederate artist. All of them worked for Battles and Leaders. So it was lavishly illustrated as well, and fun for people to read. Well, I don't want to take more time about the preamble, because we've got the man that this was my Ulysses S. Grant. Because my idea for Random House was, I'm going to do this book, but I want to divide it up into year by year of the war and ask an expert to comment on each year of the war. And they said, well, can you get Jim McPherson? I said, I don't know. I'll ask Jim McPherson. And he said, no. He said, yes, right away. So we got it together. And Jim did 1863, a terrific introduction about that watershed year. And the Confederate high water mark at Gettysburg, so-called. But we thought we'd start where we are now. We're at the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the year. What the New York Times called the first act of the great tragedy of the age, the firing on Fort Sumter. And I thought we have Jim here, who has written the great book about the Civil War, the enduringly great book about the Civil War, so we thought we'd spend time talking about the outbreak of the war and then afterwards talk to you and get your questions in about anything you'd like to ask. So I will start with this question, Jim. I've heard you say to the eternal question, which is being revived again, what was the cause of the Civil War? You've said slavery caused secession and secession caused the Civil War, which is a great answer. But how do we answer the people who are now saying that it was the tariff, the economy, state rights, and other things?
Well, we answer them by saying that issues like the tariff, the rights of states versus the right of the federal government, other issues of American politics in the first half of the 19th century, or the bread and butter issues of American politics throughout our history that have formed the basis for debates in Congress about whether the government ought to play a larger or a smaller role in promoting the economy, whether it ought to protect American manufacturers and American labor from foreign competition or ought to allow free trade. This goes all the way back to Hamilton and Jefferson, issues like the First Bank of the United States and Hamilton's report on manufacturers. These have been issues that have generated a lot of heat and sometimes some light in American history right from the beginning down to today. But they have never caused the complete breakup of the United States. They have never caused a civil war. These were issues that could be worked out within the political system. And even though the political system today may seem broken in some ways, I think we're going to see an extension of the debt limit. We're going to see some kind of agreement on the deficit, despite all of the heated debate in Washington about that. And it's not going to cause a civil war. But the issue of slavery turned out to be irreconcilable because it went to the very basis of what each section now, the slave states and the free states, saw as vital to their economy, to their social organization, and increasingly to the moral values by which they lived. So that by the 1840s and 1850s, this had become an uncompromisable institution, which took the form of whether slavery was going to be allowed to expand into the new territories acquired from Mexico, the territories that had been organized from the Louisiana Purchase as far back as 1803. And that turned out to be an issue on which Congress and the country as a whole really could not reach any kind of an agreement, any kind of a compromise. And as a result, when Abraham Lincoln was elected president on the basis of a party that was based on the principle of excluding the further expansion of slavery, as Lincoln put it in the House Divided Address in 1858, to put it in the course of ultimate extinction, that was something that could not be reconciled within the American political system. And the southern states left the Union. So there's no question but that the uncompromisable issue of slavery, and especially of slavery expansion, caused secession. Now, secession does not necessarily have to lead to war. The United States government, the states that remained within the United States, could have said, erring sisters, depart in peace. And there were a number of people in the North and even in the United States government who thought that that might be the best solution. But the incoming Lincoln administration insisted that the United States was one nation, indivisible, that tolerating secession would constitute a fatal precedent by which a disaffected minority in the future could call up that precedent and secede from the United States if they didn't like the outcome of a presidential election, which is what, of course, had sparked secession of the Deep South states in 1860 and 61. And so they admitted that secession was not acceptable. And that became another uncompromisable issue. And it was that issue that led to the spark that set off the Civil War, the Confederate decision to fire on Fort Sumter. But clearly that never would have happened if there had not been secession, and there would not have been secession had it not been for the controversy over slavery. If slavery had never existed in Britain's North American colonies and then in the United States, there would have been no Civil War from 1861 to 1865. I think that's as plain as a pikestaff, to use a 19th-century expression.
Actually, Lincoln has three opportunities for compromise, in a way. He has, during the interregnum between the election and the inauguration, both Congress and an independent peace convention come up with plans to avoid further secession. It's then limited only to 5, then 6, then 7 states, to extend the Missouri Compromise, to revive Missouri Compromise and extend slavery westward to the Pacific Ocean, to create some new slave states, to placate the fears of the slaveholding republic that that slavery is on the course of ultimate extinction. Lincoln says, hold fast, the tug has to come, and better now than later, hold fast as with a chain of steel. And then the second compromise, as you say, comes, do we let the erring sisters go? And the answer is, he can't, the Union is too important. And then we get to the third, which is, do you let Fort Sumter go just for tactical reasons? And, you know, it was almost an indefensible fort from, well, it was indefensible from the Charleston side because it faced the ocean against imagined foreign assault. But Lincoln decides not to compromise there, but he gets pretty clever about it. And why don't we talk about the lead-in there, the what Lincoln might have done, what he decided to do, and also what Davis probably ill-advisedly did on that spark that you said was set off.
Well, Fort Sumter was a real tinderbox that as early as January 1861, it was clear to people on both sides that the showdown was likely to come there. The state of South Carolina, and especially the city of Charleston, were the most red-hot, fire-eating secessionist regions of the South. Yet the United States Army, under Major Robert Anderson, had occupied Fort Sumter on the day after Christmas, 1860, with about 80-some soldiers. And they became the hostages to peace or war. Not only was Fort Sumter oriented toward defending Charleston from the sea, but also it was built to accommodate about 600 soldiers, and they only had 80 there. So clearly there were not enough men to man its guns when it did come under attack from the South Carolina and now Confederate militia. The question of whether or not to withdraw the troops from Fort Sumter in the interest of preserving the peace by avoiding an incident was something that was very much debated within the Lincoln administration. In the first 2 weeks of the Lincoln administration, that is from March 4th until about March 20th or so, Lincoln held a number of cabinet meetings, and most of his cabinet members said, pull the troops out. But one of them, Montgomery Blair, protested against that. The main argument for doing so would be that this would keep the peace. It would not play into the hands of the Southern fire eaters who were looking for an excuse to fire on Fort Sumter, to seize this bone of contention, bone of United States government contention within the harbor of the leading secessionist city, and that it would preserve the peace long enough for maybe Southern secessionists to come to their senses and encourage what many in the North assumed was a silent majority of Southerners in the states that had seceded that really were Unionists at heart, that were closet Americans who had been swept into secession by the passions of the moment. But if they could only maintain this status quo for a few more weeks, maybe a few more months, the Southern Unionists would come out of the closet, would reassert control of their states, and some sort of negotiated restoration of the Union would be possible. The foremost advocate of this policy, watchful waiting, a Fabian policy, it went under many names, voluntary reconstruction, was Secretary of State William H. Seward. And Seward was really working behind Lincoln's back to reassure Southerners that, in fact, Lincoln would pull the troops out of Fort Sumter. And a majority of the cabinet and his general-in-chief, Winfield Scott, favored that policy at first.
And looking to Florida as another place where they might
draw the line. That's true. Fort Pickens, just outside Pensacola Harbor, was also another fort in a secessionist state that was still held by Union troops. And if they could swap, if they could hold Pickens but give up Sumter, that would maintain the peace, but would also maintain the principle of federal supremacy over federal property in the South. But Montgomery Blair, Lincoln himself, I think, did not see it that way. They saw, they thought that pulling out of Sumter would be a signal of weakness, that rather than strengthening these closet unionists in the South, it would discourage them, that it would constitute a kind of de jure recognition of Confederate sovereignty and therefore of Confederate independence. It might even encourage foreign nations to recognize the Confederacy diplomatically as a new nation. And so Lincoln decided to try to hold on to Sumter, but to do so without making it an act of provocation. And he came up with, I think, an ingenious solution, which was to organize an expedition to resupply Fort Sumter with provisions. The Confederates had cut off the supplies of food, and Major Anderson had told the government that he could hold out for only a few more weeks. So he would be starved out if nothing was done. So Lincoln decides to send provisions, food for hungry men, and to back it up with troops who would fight their way in if necessary, if the Confederates attacked Fort Sumter or attacked the supply mission, but also to notify the governor of South Carolina ahead of time that this was going to be done, to make it a public event, and to say that if you allow these supplies to go in, we will not open fire on you. But if you open fire on the supply ships or on the fort, then we'll fight back. Basically, Lincoln was flipping a coin and telling Jefferson Davis, heads I win, tails you lose. If Jefferson Davis and his government decide to allow the supplies to go in, they will lose face. And Fort Sumter will be able to hold out indefinitely. But if he attacks the supply ships or attacks Fort Sumter before they get there, then the Confederates will be convicted of firing the first shot, which will unite the North, and the North was divided about what to do on this very vexed question of Fort Sumter and indeed the larger question of secession. But if the Confederate artillery fires on American soldiers, on the American flag, that's going to unite the North. So that's why Lincoln, in effect, tosses this coin and tells Jefferson Davis, heads I win, tails you lose. The Confederate cabinet and President Jefferson Davis do not hesitate. They send orders to General Beauregard to fire on Fort Sumter before the ships get there. Beauregard gives that order. They fire on Fort Sumter starting at 4:30 in the morning on April 12, 1861, and that starts the war and does unite the North, at least for the time being, in support of this effort to crush traitors now. These are traitors. These are rebels. These are rebels against the United States government and its sovereignty. And as a consequence, the war begins under the best possible circumstances for uniting the Northern people. In many ways, I think the Confederate attack on Fort Sumter, even though it doesn't come as a surprise, the way the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941 did, nevertheless has pretty much the same effect on the Northern people as the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor did on the American people in 1941. And so the war starts off on a footing that basically unites people on both sides, because when Lincoln issues the call for militia to suppress what he calls combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings, in other words, an insurrection, that tends to unite Southern whites in support of the Confederacy in four more states, Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas, secede and join the Confederacy and make it a very powerful concern So you have set the stage for what turns out to be the devastating four-year civil war.
You know, politicians need luck. I've always, as someone who's worked in politics, I know that you need an element of luck. And Lincoln does toss a coin. But something else happened at Sumter that's worth recalling that added to the Northern fighting spirit and the unification of the North in suppressing, in the attitude favoring the suppression of this insurrection. And keep in mind that Lincoln is not the figure that most people talk about from the election of 1860 is that Lincoln gets about 39.9% of the popular vote. More important to this discussion is the fact that he got about 53% and change of the Northern vote, maybe closer to 54. But that still meant that 46% of Northerners in non-seceding states were opposed to Abraham Lincoln and his presidential candidacy. He's coming to the presidency facing the worst crisis that ever faced any incoming president, with a divided electorate to some degree, even in the region that he needs for overwhelming support in case of an emergency. 55-45 is a really good number to win an election by, but it's not a good number to wage a war by. Well, what happens? Jim described the tense moments leading up to Sumter and the attack. Something very visceral, something very elemental happens as well. One of those shells that's fired from Charleston strikes down the staff that holds the American flag over Sumter. The flag falls, and it's jerry-rigged back up, and it falls again. It's captured, allegedly dragged through the streets of Charleston, and returned to Major Robert Anderson. He then packs it up and takes it home to New York City. Well, not home. He takes it to New York. He's sent to New York, my town. And, you know, Lincoln has not done as well in New York as he's done in Philadelphia. He's only gotten about 30% of the vote in New York City. Anderson writes later that he doesn't know when he heads to New York whether he's going to be court-martialed or given a parade. He's given a parade. And the reason is, as every newspaper in New York and soon all over the country writes, is that the flag has been desecrated. The flag has been fired upon. And you see a phenomenon that the press describes as flag mania erupting, people buying flags. And my, you know, good old New York, we raised the prices of the flags, you know. Red, white, and blue bunting went up in price. Supply and demand, you know how it is. So, but the flag flew in New York in Union Square. The flag of Sumter was draped over the equestrian statue of George Washington in Union Square. Draped over a jewelry store, a new jewelry establishment on Lower Broadway as the 7th Regiment marches off to war. Quite an extraordinary phenomenon, and I think, again, luck has something to do with it. The phenomenon of the desecration of the flag really gets the North angry, and you see it in song sheets and poetry. Jim alluded to what Lincoln did next, and we should go there next. And Lincoln's response, since this he judges is an extraordinary event, is to call for 75,000 volunteers, not dollars, and a blockade of southern ports. This he does while Congress is out of session. He does it by executive fiat. We're in a moment now when Congress has kicked back at President Obama for not asking for approval for the Libyan efforts with NATO. Similar situation, except Congress is out of session. So what does Lincoln do? He calls Congress back into session in 2.5 months. One of the most interesting, another roll of the dice, another coin flip. He wants Congress to come back and validate what he does, and soon added to that is his order to suspend the writ of habeas corpus along the line from Philadelphia to Washington, where troops have to march to get to the defense of Washington. And although the power of suspending the writ is not specifically assigned to Congress, at least by clear language, it's in the congressional section of the Constitution. Lincoln again acts alone. He has a lot of nerve and to hold off until July 4th. So let's talk about that, and let's talk about that extraordinary special message to Congress. It was actually July 5th. It's always listed as July 4th, 1861. About 150 years ago, Lincoln rallies Congress to the support of the war. He's rallied the people, and now he has to rally the people who need to fund the war.
Well, the reason that Lincoln didn't call Congress until July 4th is primarily because in those days, congressional elections were held at different times. Today, they're all held on the same date, or at least approximately the same date, since we now have some states that have voting that goes over a period of a week or two, in November. But in those days, there were a number of states that held their elections later than that. And so there were some states that had not yet held congressional elections in April of 1861. And in order for full Congress to meet from all of the states that remain in the United States, Lincoln wanted to wait until the spring congressional elections in a few states. But I think he was also quite prepared to take executive action to suppress this rebellion. When he called for the 75,000 militia troops, basically he's calling the state militia into federal service. That was based on a 1795 Militia Act, which gave the president the power to do so in cases of insurrection or rebellion or even invasion if Congress was not in session. And the service of those men was to be limited to 90 days. So that's why these were the 3 month militia. Lincoln calls them into federal service. About twice as many are offered by the state governors as Lincoln calls for, many more than the 75,000. Another piece of evidence of this kind of rage militaire, this outpouring of emotional patriotism in the North. The number of troops offered to the federal government under Lincoln's call was radically oversubscribed. Lincoln suspends the writ of habeas corpus. He also enlarges the regular Army and Navy by executive action, which, of course, does preempt congressional prerogative. The Constitution says that Congress shall raise and support an Army and Navy. Lincoln also calls for three-year volunteers in addition to these 90-day militia. Another executive action that kind of usurps the authority of Congress. And he justifies this on the grounds of the emergency, that Congress can't be called into session, special session for more than 2 months. But the crisis is now. And I think that that begins a process by which Lincoln, through executive actions of one sort or another, the Emancipation Proclamation, of course, is one of the outstanding examples of that later in the war, expands the power of the presidency, justifying it on the basis of his constitutional authority as commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy and of the militia when called into federal service. That becomes the constitutional basis for a whole series of extraordinary actions taken by Lincoln without congressional authorization. Now, in the case of the actions he took in 1861, when Congress does finally come into session in July and August of 1861, they pass a bill saying that that legitimizes what Lincoln has done as if it had been enacted by Congress. I love the language of that legislation. I don't think you could get Congress to do that for a president today. But here was another example of Northern unity at that early stage of the war, that Congress is willing to ratify ex post facto, as it were, extraordinary actions taken by Lincoln under no authority except his claimed authority as commander-in-chief.
But he does think that a lot is weighing on this piece of writing, that he allegedly closes his doors, an extraordinary thing in the early days of his presidency, because he's so busy dealing with federal office seekers and visitors and diplomats coming for the first time. But he closes his doors and allegedly spends 2 weeks working on this message. And if you read it, and I recommend it to you, you know, in this day when presidents need occasionally to seek congressional authority for these things. I find it a peculiar message in many ways. It's a little bit organizationally disjointed. It has fits and starts. It has soaring rhetoric and then goes back to a more prosaic tone. Then you get another bon mot or a soundbite, as we'd call it today. This is a people's contest, et cetera. And then he goes back to a different tone, and then he comes back again. It's not his greatest speech, but in a way, I think it's one of his most important speeches because he makes the point that whatever the process, whatever the normal process is, a government can't be so weak that it can't defend its own existence in an emergency. And it's really quite an extraordinary speech. Supposedly, when I was just been doing some research on it because it's fun to get into the exact 150th anniversary events on their birthdays. And it was, of course, it's probably the greatest speech that Lincoln never read aloud of all of his great speeches because, like the annual messages, what we now call State of the Union messages, they were submitted by his private secretary in an envelope to the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House and then read to the members of Congress by a clerk who wasn't dramatically trained to read as Lincoln would have preferred. But supposedly when he talked about 400,000 men, ultimately $400 million, he got wild applause in the Congress. So it must have worked, even without the great reading and the very slow reading, by the way. Lincoln was a very slow public speaker. But it worked.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lincoln was a lawyer, and most of the members of Congress were lawyers, and I think he was trying to make a strong legal case mm-hmm. in this message, as in some of his other messages. So that's why you get the alternating sort of legalese language with some occasional soaring rhetoric in this message and in his annual messages as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in the annual messages, of course, he has the responsibility of reporting on an incredible array of mundane facts, postal deliveries and all of that. It's hard to believe that we're using so much time and we've just about gotten to 150 years ago today. But I wanted to, the other highlight of 1861 that's worth noting is, of course, Manassas, Bull Run, which is the moment when this war is supposed to end. And the northern 90-day recruits are supposed to triumph, and everybody enjoys a picnic lunch and goes home. It's not what happens, of course, and it's just the beginning. And there are four more years and hundreds of thousands of casualties to come. How close do you think the Union came to actually winning? They won the first half of the battle. Unfortunately, there are two halves in the battle like a football game. How close?
The morning of July 21st, 1861, and the early afternoon looked like it was going to be a Union victory. For a variety of reasons, one, I think the raw nature, or the troops were green. They had never been in action before. They'd had only a minimum amount of training. This was a day on which most of the Union troops had arisen at 2 o'clock in the morning to begin fording Bull Run to get in position to make this attack. By the early afternoon, the temperature was in the mid-90s. They were exhausted. Fresh Confederate troops, one brigade of whom were just off the train at Manassas Junction, having been transferred from the Shenandoah Valley, where General Robert Patterson was supposed to keep them occupied, but this septuagenarian commander did not do his job. And a Confederate counterattack against, I think, these exhausted Union troops in late afternoon set them to rout. As you say, it's who wins the second half or maybe the final few minutes of a basketball game, football game, whatever it might be, or a battle, is going to make the difference. And it turned into an embarrassing defeat for the Union Army. and a kind of comical, tragicomic disaster for some of those people who had come out from Washington with their picnic lunches to watch the rebels get whipped, as they often said. But I think in the long run, it was probably advantageous to the Union cause that they encountered this defeat, because it now became clear that this war was not going to be a picnic. The Lincoln administration and I think the Northern people really settled down to the long haul and to a more determined mobilization after the failure of this original campaign, this original Forward to Richmond campaign in July of 1861. It might have even contributed to what we might call the victory disease for the Confederates. You know, after the Japanese success in the first 6 months of World War II, the Japanese became so overconfident and so arrogant that their later historians called it the victory disease. They underestimated the enemy, overestimated their own capacity. And I think that something of the sort happened with the Confederacy. They thought they had won the war. At the same time that Northerners buckled down to a much more determined much better organized effort. And in the long run, it may have been healthy to lose that battle.
It's quite an interesting way of looking at it. Well, the 1861 section of Battles and Leaders includes articles by General Beauregard, by General Johnston, goes on to Pea Ridge, and of course, opens with Sumter. So it's just a taste of what went on. But one of the interesting stories that's not in Battles and Leaders, but I enjoy it a great deal because it's about a project I'm working on now about the press in the Civil War era. Henry Raymond, the editor of the New York Times, thought that he should be there to cover the beginning and end of the war, the Union victory that would end the war. And he went there and reported great. After the morning, he sent a wire back that was dispatched to the New York Times. Union wins marvelous victory. Southerners repelled. War is over, basically. Then he went back to the battlefield and was nearly trampled by all the retreating Union soldiers. And so he flees with the troops back to Washington to file a report about this terrible upset victory in the second half. And he files the report and gives it to the military telegraph operator, and the telegraph operator looks at it and says, oh, I don't think this is really the right thing to send back to New York. We don't want a report like this. It's terribly negative. And he doesn't send it. The New York Times, he gets on a train. The New York Times readers don't learn that the Union has lost the Battle of Bull Run for another couple of days. So it will also be an age of information control and a whole different world. Before we're going to take questions in a minute, but I just wanted to leave you with one thing. As these battles are beginning in Virginia, and you know they'll soon, in a couple of years, reach Pennsylvania, and that's the section for which Jim wrote an introduction. This city is very much on Abraham Lincoln's mind always during the war. He comes here to the Union League. He donates his Emancipation Proclamation printings. He signs them so they could be sold for the benefit of wounded soldiers here. But I think one of the most interesting things he does relative to this city, because he's always worried that it's going to be in the line of Robert E. Lee's troops, is after Gettysburg, he celebrates by writing a poem about your city. And I'm going to read it to you and end with that. This is his summary of the Battle of Gettysburg. In 1863, with pomp and mighty swell, me and Jeff's Confederacy went forth to sack Philadel. The Yankees, they got after us and gave us particular hell, and we skedaddled back again and didn't sack Philadel. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here today. So thank you, and we'll open it to questions.
Well, it's a good thing Lincoln didn't quit his day job. So, raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. And, whoa, okay, right here in front. Morris?
Thank you for a fascinating conversation. I wonder if your research give any additional perspective on Robert E. Lee's decision to go back to the South, and was there anything that the Union government and or Army could have done that would have influenced him?
Well, I'll just start by saying Battles and Leaders doesn't deal with that. Lee was dead by the time that this project was begun. It would have been interesting had he lived to write an essay. But Jim can talk about whether there was any chance that more persuasion might have... I don't think more persuasion could have convinced him, as he put it, to raise his hand against his native state. But Jim can opine as well.
No, I don't think Lee hesitated more than a moment about that decision. As soon as Virginia seceded, or as soon as the Virginia Convention voted to secede on April 17th, 1861, Lee's mind was made up for him. His family, his associates in Virginia, his state had now taken the plunge. And even though on that very day, or maybe it was the following day, he had been offered command of the principal field army for the Union, and his mentor in many ways, General Winfield Scott, who was also a Virginian and was General-in-Chief of the United States Army, tried to persuade him to remain loyal to the United States, to remain loyal to the service in which he had spent his entire career since he had graduated from West Point back in 1829, I guess it was.
And graduated at federal expense.
At federal expense. But he said, I cannot raise my sword against Virginia, against my family and friends, and made that fateful decision to go with Virginia rather than stay with the United States.
And some Virginians...
Some Virginians did make a different decision.
Winfield Scott.
Winfield Scott himself, of course. George Thomas, who became one of the principal Union commanders, was a Virginian.
Not a lot, but some.
David Glasgow Farragut was living in Virginia, in Norfolk at the time. His wife was a Virginian. In fact, she was named Virginia. and he himself was from Tennessee. He made the decision, of course, became the foremost Union naval officer. Mm-hmm. So there were United States officers, Navy and Army, from southern states who made a different decision, but I don't think Lee hesitated.
Right here in the second row, lady in the middle.
You talked about the election of Congress and the Congress returning and confirming Lincoln's wishes. How did the Civil War affect the operation of Congress without the South? And were there Southern justices on the Supreme Court, and how did that work?
There were Southern justices at the outbreak of the war. Some left. Lincoln actually thought for to left vacancies for a much longer time than one would expect, and he actually harbored the thought that these were Southern seats and maybe he should find other Southerners before he was wisely advised to not pursue that course. Congress met and new quorum numbers were established. A quorum of the whole became a quorum of the loyal states, and it continued to operate. And it didn't operate easily. Lincoln had as much trouble in his first off-year election nearly as President Obama did in his first off-year election. After the Emancipation Proclamation was issued 6 weeks before what was not quite a universal election day but an important election period, October, November of 1862, the Republicans took a drubbing in Congress, and it made operations for Lincoln and quite a bit more difficult.
They did retain control of the yes. House, though, unlike Obama.
But they lost governorships, they lost state legislatures.
Let's continue. Gentleman in the second row here in the blue.
Thank you. Is there a good explanation for why the South seemed to have so much better, so many better generals than the North, or at least that seems to be the common perception?
I think that's a misconception, and it's a misconception based on the overemphasis, sometimes almost exclusive concentration on the what was called the Eastern Theater or the Virginia Theater in the Civil War, where it's quite true that Confederate commanders were probably more able than their Union counterparts, or certainly more aggressive. And I think that McClellan probably infected the Army of the Potomac with his own cautious defensive-mindedness. But if you look at the whole theater of the war, including a much larger, vaster theater, the Western Theater, I think you'd come to a different impression. In the Western Theater, you've got the emergence of Grant, of Sherman, of Sheridan, of Thomas. They all come out of the Union Western Theater, and they, by 1863 or 1864, have emerged as the top Union commanders. And if you looked at only the Western Theater, and especially events in the first half of 1862, when the Union forces in Tennessee and Mississippi and Arkansas, Alabama are sweeping all before them, you would say, why is it that the Confederates have such a paltry collection of commanders in the Western Theater? So if you balance it out, I don't think that this is a very common impression, and I'm asked this all the time, is really an accurate one.
I would add only that at the beginning of the war, remember, Lincoln faces the need to unite the North. Emotionalism about flags is only going to last so long. And what he needs to do is make sure that Democrats get generalships, that ethnic leaders get generalships. So he has a series of Democratic appointments, German-American appointments, Carl Schurz, a very good orator, but a very bad general, Franz Sigel, others. He needs to do this, I think. But the reputation, I think, grows somewhat out of the political and ethnic generals.
That's true.
Gentleman about six rows back on the aisle there, the blue shirt. Keep your hand up, sir. Thank you.
Is it possible that the South would have fared a lot better had Jefferson Davis held off on the firing on Fort Sumter, being as so many of the defeats that followed for the South, especially in the West, were because the South was ill-prepared for war. They didn't have supply lines that they needed. And if he had waited, it would have given them more time to build their resources.
Well, we can't know the answer to that question. It's quite plausible that if Davis had held off on Fort Sumter and that the war had not started in April 1861 and had not started under the circumstances that it did, the Confederacy might well have fared better. But I don't think the Confederate cabinet and Davis himself really hesitated. There's some evidence that that there was dissent within the Confederate cabinet, but for the most part, Robert Toombs, who was that time the Secretary of State, later was claimed to have opposed the firing on Fort Sumter because it would cause the northern people to swarm like bees and sting the South to death. But I think that's based more on hindsight than Toombs's opinion. He was a pretty hot-headed character in 1861. I think under the circumstances, just as Lee's decision to go with the Confederacy seemed pretty inevitable, I think the Confederate decision to attack Fort Sumter before the relief mission got there was also pretty inevitable. That's not to say that if they had waited, had not attacked, they might have fared better, but that's something we can't know for sure.
Gentleman in the third row right here, and we'll move back.
What was the status of the Anaconda Plan?
I'm sorry?
What was the status of the Anaconda Plan at the beginning of the war?
The status of it.
Was it followed? Was it ignored?
Well, I mean, my view of the blockade plan, this is another name for the blockade plan, this large snake enveloping southern ports, is that it always had limited effectiveness. I mean, it's very hard to blanket the entire eastern and southern coast of the United States, effectively bottling up commerce to the degree that it would have completely ended foreign trade with the South. But it was an interesting public relations move, and ultimately had its effect militarily. It was, on the other hand, there are historians who think it won the war by causing ultimately. I think there are two things at work here, and one is the Confederate economy focusing on war and using its material for war, and the other is a slow depletion of foreign imports. So there are those who give Winfield Scott and his plan the credit for the ultimate triumph of the Union.
Well, the Anaconda plan had two parts. One was the blockade to shut out foreign imports in the Confederacy and exports of cotton to pay for them. The other was Scott's idea that you would train a joint operation of Army and Navy and move down the Mississippi River to gain control of the Mississippi River and seal off the Confederacy from that side by water as well as by the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico. And in the end, this was a central part of Union strategy, both the blockade and the campaign to gain control of the Mississippi River. But leaving it at that, I think, would not be sufficient to win the war. The Confederacy existed on the back of its armies. And until those armies were defeated, and so badly defeated, that they could no longer carry the Confederacy, could no longer maintain resistance, the Confederacy was going to continue to exist. And so the essential part of Union strategy that was missing from the Anaconda Plan was a definite strategy to confront Confederate armies and beat them. Mm-hmm. And that's what it took in the end. The war wasn't over until Lee surrendered at Appomattox.
Not when the Mississippi was flowing unvexed to the sea.
And the Mississippi had been flowing unvexed to the sea for nearly 2 years by that time.
Let's see, there's a gentleman in orange all the way back there, and then there was, right here in the third row. We'll go to you next.
Prior to the start of the Civil War, there was a lot of compromising going on. Men like Henry Clay and Daniel Webster and John C. Calhoun seemed to kind of find ways of doing things while going to war. Do you think if somebody had been a strong leader rather than James Buchanan in the White House, like, say, if Henry Clay had been a president, that things might have been different?
I mean, one thing that happened differently after the passing of that generation was that Stephen Douglas, Lincoln's arch political rival in Illinois and ultimately for the presidency, devised this new way that he thought anxiety over slavery would be reduced, and that is to allow voters in each territory to decide for themselves whether to accept slavery as they pursued the path to statehood. He thought, just as California thought, that if you have budgetary referenda, the state would never go into bankruptcy, that if the people decided, it would be in the American spirit, in the American way. Of course, it excluded people of color from voting about their own fate. And it opened the door for settlers to become a permanent voting class, going from state to state, voting, and then moving on to do the same. What it did, rather than perpetuate the spirit of compromise, was incite anti-slavery people, including Abraham Lincoln, to come back into politics and demand that popular sovereignty not be the law of the land. And it was that enormous pushback against what seems like, you know, in a certain way, like a reasonable solution that ended the spirit of compromise. It took seven more years for the explosion to come, as Lincoln said, but I think it wasn't the passing of the generations, and it wasn't James Buchanan, as bad a leader as he was, especially in the last 2 years of his administration. I think it was that moment.
I echo all that.
I think I'm the one that's being called on. Did the South have any significant loss of its cotton markets, such as the Northern Mills, England, etc.? And if so, how and why did it occur? And if so, what effect, if any, did it have upon the Southern economy?
There was an enormous decline in cotton production in the South, and especially in cotton exports, both to the North and to Europe. At first, this was actually kind of a voluntary embargo by the Confederacy. In the summer and fall of 1861, there was the so-called King Cotton theory in the South that if they withheld exports of cotton to Britain and to France, but especially to Britain, that that would force the European powers to intervene to break the blockade so that they could get cotton. This was a radical overreach, I think, by the Southerners, partly because, as it turned out, there had been bumper crops in 1859 and 1860 that actually created something of a surplus of cotton and of cotton textiles on the market, so that the so-called cotton famine that the Southern states, that the Confederacy was counting on to force the Europeans to intervene, maybe even to force the northern textile mill owners to put pressure on their own government to negotiate some kind of a settlement with the South, was delayed until well into 1862. And by 1862, the Union blockade was now becoming more effective. And so the decline in cotton exports, it just fell off the table. First because of this voluntary embargo in 1861, and then by the increasing effectiveness of the Union blockade in 1862, which drove up the price of cotton. The price of cotton in, on the eve of the Civil War was about 11 cents a pound, raw cotton. It drove it up in the Liverpool market to 80 or 90 cents. But none of that was not going to the southern cotton producers. That was going to the shipping companies, which charged much more and for more insurance to try to run this cotton through the blockade. And they did get cotton through the blockade, but it was far less than was exported in peacetime. During the course of the war, we don't have exact data on this, but something like a million bales of cotton. It may have been less than that. It may have been only 500,000, but we'll say 1 million had been exported from the Confederate States over 4 years. Now, that sounds like a lot, but the average export for each of the pre-war years was 3 million bales. So if there had been no war, the number of exports during the course of the 4 years of war would have been about 12 million bales of cotton. In fact, it was 1 million or less. That gives you an idea. And even though the price of cotton went up, it was the blockade runners and those who financed them rather than the cotton growers in the South who benefited from that increase in price.
So we've got time for one more question, so it's going to be a good one. The lady about 10 rows back in the yellow with her hand up. Yeah, Carmine, if you could get to her. She's standing up. Yeah, you do, because we're recording it, ma'am. It's the only way we're all going to hear it.
It's being recorded. You're on candid camera.
I was always wondering what would the United States look like now if the South had succeeded? I know, you know, you will never know it for sure, but what do you think? Would it look like Europe?
Yeah, it would look like Yugoslavia breaking up again and again. That was Lincoln's point. I tend to agree with him that if the southern states could leave at will over a single issue, then the western states in the north could leave over a similar issue. In the end, we'd have, jumping ahead in terminology, a balkanized continent too weak to defend itself against future growth and aggression from anywhere else in the world. I think Lincoln thought about that a great deal, and he also thought about what America represented as an ideal that could stimulate democracy and opportunity in the rest of the world. A growing number of Americans were emigres from the failed revolutions in Europe and brought with them a sense of despair over the absence of popular government. Lincoln believed that America had to succeed as a single nation to illuminate the rest of the world. We've heard it disdainfully and disrespectfully referred to in recent years as this impractical idea that we can export democracy. But Lincoln believed in that, and he believed it could only come by showing that our American experiment in democracy had only been created, but had shown that it could protect itself against interruption and against a threat from inside.
Perfect end to a perfect evening. Please join me in thanking Harold Holzer and Jim McPherson. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.